listening to Radio Maria, Christian voice in your home. Right now, presenting the show, Jesus the Promised Messiah of Judaism, Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome again to Jesus the Promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the fulfillment, the full realization of the Catholic Church, of Judaism in the Catholic Church and her sacraments. Last week I spent most of the show talking about the Desert Fathers, or rather reading quotes from the Desert Fathers and talking about them, since they lived, by and large, were in the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries, lived in a state of continual prayer and self-renunciation and, to the extent possible, intimacy with God. They certainly have a tremendous depth of wisdom and understanding of the spiritual ways, of the ways that God works spiritually with the human soul. That's far beyond what most others have. And all my readings from last week happened to be from St. Anthony of the Desert. That wasn't my intention, but that's the way it worked out. Then imagine my surprise a couple of days later when I went to Mass and found that it was the feast day of St. Anthony of the Desert. So perhaps he had inspired the choice of readings for that show. And in part for that reason, my intention today is to continue with readings from the Desert Fathers, ones subsequent, other Desert Fathers besides St. Anthony of the Desert, and reflect on I don't want to say not really reflect on what they have to say, but perhaps do a little exegesis on what they have to say. And my intention is also to similarly read from St. Ignatius of Loyola on the same theme that will be coming up in these readings from the Desert Fathers, which is essentially the interior spiritual warfare that is the substance of the attempt to grow closer to God in one's consciousness and in one's interior wisdom and in the interior morality of one's behavior. This actually gets to a point of contrast between Judaism and the Catholic Church. Remember, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount said that Moses said, for instance, not to commit adultery, but I tell you that he who has lusted after another woman in his heart has committed adultery in his heart, and so forth. In other words, the commandments of the old law prescribed behavior and were focused on behavior, and the new intimacy with God, which was made possible by the incarnation of Jesus Christ, requires, in addition to the control of behavior not to sin, a kind of interior control, a watchfulness over one's interior life to enable, essentially, one's thoughts and one's feelings to be sufficiently pure so that, if you excuse the expression, you know, God can stand to be in communion with you, that God can stand, so to speak, to be united to those thoughts and feelings, which is obviously not going to be the case if there is a lot of ugliness or sin in those thoughts and feelings. Now, there are two dimensions, so to speak, in one's thoughts and feelings that have to be distinguished. One is the existence of temptation, the thoughts that are presented to one against one's will or not with one's consent, which are occasions of temptation, but they're not occasions of sin. However, at the point where that thought is presented to one, one has the choice to follow with that thought, to kind of engage it, God forbid even to enjoy the consideration of that thought. And at that point, there is a consent of the will to that thought, and at that point, there is an element of sin which enters in, whereas the alternative is to, as soon as one becomes aware of a sinful thought, to try to reject it, to push it away, at which point the temptation of that thought merely becomes an opportunity for the exercise of virtue and the gain of merit. So I guess with that backdrop, let me go back to reading from the Desert Fathers. The first three or four or five quotes that I will be reading will in fact be from St. Anthony of the Desert, but then I will go on to others of the Desert Fathers. By the way, the show is, of course, Jesus the Promised Messiah of Judaism. It's not meant to be about the Desert Fathers or about spiritual warfare per se, and I promise that next week's show will return to a more mainstream topic for the theme of the show. Anyway, however, for today, let's go to this discussion of interior spiritual warfare with a reading from, at the moment, St. Anthony the Great, St. Anthony of the Desert. However, if a man arms himself with patience and an unswerving faithfulness to the commandments of God, the Holy Spirit will teach his mind how to purify his soul and body from such movements. But if at any time he weakens in his feeling and permits himself to neglect the commandments and ordinances he has heard, the evil spirits will begin to overpower him, will press upon all parts of the body, and will befoul it by this movement, until the tormented soul will not know where to turn in its despair, seeing nowhere from where help could come. Only when, sobered, it returns again to the commandments, and shouldering their yoke, commits itself to the Holy Spirit, it regains a salutary disposition. Then it understands that it should seek peace solely in God, and that only thus is peace possible. Now, I'm jumping in the middle here a little bit in St. Anthony the Great, for which I apologize. The saint is discussing how to gain mastery over one's thoughts, because gaining mastery over one's thoughts is necessary in order to maintain a state of interior peace, and also in order to protect oneself from temptations which are produced by the enemy introducing thoughts, and then the will carelessly falling into consent with those thoughts and thereby sinning. And what St. Anthony is pointing out here is the preconditions for gaining such control over one's thoughts is patience and faithfulness to the commandments of God. In other words, a purification of one's interior life is a second stage, so to speak, when a purification or correction of one's external actions are the first phase. So if one does not strive to obey the commandments in one's actions, in one's external behavior, one will not have the grace to gain mastery over one's interior actions, over the flow of one's thoughts. So, as St. Anthony said, if a man arms himself with an unswerving faithfulness to the commandments of God, the Holy Spirit will teach his mind how to purify his soul and body from such movements being the introduction of thoughts by the evil one. And it's this purification of his soul and his thoughts which present the canvas, so to speak, on which God can communicate, through which God can infuse the mind with a kind of a direct inspiration of wisdom and even of fellowship with God. Continuing for the moment with St. Anthony of the Desert. It is not unknown to you that the enemies of truth never cease to strive to destroy truth, but God at all times, from the very beginning of the creation of the world, has visited his creation and taught those who approach their Creator with all their heart how they must worship him. But through the passionate nature of the flesh and the malice of the enemies who fight us, the good tendencies of the soul lost their power, and men could not even grasp what was proper to them according to their nature and designation, let alone free themselves of sins to regain their original state. Then God showed them mercy and taught them true worship through written law. But when even this failed, God, seeing that the wound grows wider and demands drastic treatment, determined to send down his only begotten Son, who is our only physician. So let me break this down a little bit. God's intention from the very beginning of the creation of the world was to enable man to approach their Creator with all their heart and worship him. That's, in some sense, what God created man for, was a two-way fellowship with man, for God to love us and for us to love and give him due reverence and worship and live with him for all eternity. Now, through Adam's fall, as St. Anthony says, the good tendencies of the soul lost their power. This is what's known as concupiscence, but basically the original harmony of the human soul was compromised, and the good tendencies of their soul, of the soul, lost their power over the rest of the soul, and men could not even grasp what was proper to them according to their nature and designation. In other words, even conscience didn't work properly, and they were unable to free themselves of sin to regain their original state. Then God showed them mercy and taught them true worship through written law. Written law referring, of course, to the Old Covenant, the written law that God gave to the Jews through Moses. So that was God's first stage, so to speak, of his attempt to restore man to unity with God. Then St. Anthony goes on to say, but when even this failed, in other words, when God saw that even the written law he gave to the Jews was did not enable them to regain their proper disposition of soul in relationship to God, but it's back to St. Anthony's words, but when even this failed, God, seeing that the wound grows wider and demands drastic treatment, determined to send down his only begotten Son, who is our only physician. In other words, and I'm not actually, how can I put this? St. Anthony's view of the relationship between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant is not necessarily precisely identical with my own. My view of it, I think, goes a little bit further. But what he's pointing out here is that God gave the law in a kind of first stage attempt to enable man to up his game, to raise his behavior, to reestablish the proper relationship with God. When even that failed, as was evidenced by the failure of the Jews to even properly fulfill the written law, God saw that more drastic measures were required, and therefore sent his only begotten Son, Jesus, our divine physician, and the only effective way for us to repair the damage in us done by original sin and actual sin and reestablish the relationship to God is through Jesus and through what he brought us and through our union with him, and through our union with him, our sanctification of our souls. A lot of this, of course, taking place through the sacraments. The place where I would add something to what St. Anthony said here is to say this is one dimension of the relationship between the written law and the divine physician, so to speak. But it's not strictly sequential in the sense that when God saw that the written law would fail, he then went to this other plan of sending Jesus. My contention is that from the very beginning, God saw that the written law would fail, so to speak, but it would be sufficient to prepare the way for the coming of Jesus, at which point the favor which was given by God to mankind, which was through the written law, which was restricted to the Jews, would be extended to all of humanity through the work of the divine physician Jesus, which was, of course, for all humanity, not for a single group. This is a live call-in program, and I do not know how much sense I'm making. If anyone wishes to call in and tell me, or rather, ask me to either clarify what I'm saying or point out gaps in what I'm saying, I would say, you're more than welcome to do so. Or if you just wish to call in on general principles and join the discussion, the number here is 866-333-6279 or 866-333-MARY, MARY. Back to Saint Anthony of the Desert and his discussion of this interior spiritual warfare inspired by the enemy of man's salvation, tempting us with the wrong kind of thoughts. How many myriads are there of evil demons, and how numberless are their varied wiles? They urge us to speak evil of one another, or speaking sweet words to conceal bitterness in our hearts, to criticize the outer aspect of our brother, while we harbor a wild beast in ourselves, to quarrel among ourselves and oppose one another, wishing to have our own way and appear as the most upright. Every man who enjoys sinful thoughts falls willingly when he welcomes the suggestions of the enemies, and when he expects to justify himself solely by his visible deeds, while within he is the abode of the spirit of wickedness who teaches him every evil. The body of such a man will be full of shameful uncleanness, for he becomes a prey to devilish passions, which he does not repulse from himself. Demons are not visible bodies, but we become their bodies when our souls accept dark thoughts from them. For having accepted these thoughts, we accept the demons themselves and make them bodily manifest. Wow, this is really a mother lode on spiritual warfare. The first thing to note here is that the battleground of spiritual warfare is between our ears, is in our mind, is in our imagination. And there are countless myriads of evil demons with even more countless myriads of wiles, of tricks, of attempts to make us fall. They urge us to speak evil of one another. They inspire us with resentful thoughts, with thoughts of envy, with thoughts of resentment, with nursing grudges, with critical thoughts of, look at how bad that thing that person is doing, or how could he have been that, unjust or whatever. They urge us to, first of all, reflect negatively on other people. Then they urge us to speak evil of others, or perhaps to speak well of them while harboring bitterness in our hearts, or to be critical of the outer aspect of our brother, while what's going on in our own souls might be 100 times worse. I'll give an example of that. I will leave the culprit in this example nameless, but somebody revealed to me or told me that he became aware that when he was at Mass, he was thinking critically of somebody who wasn't kneeling when the rest of the congregation was kneeling during the consecration, while in fact he was, basically a bachelor looking over the women in the congregation to see who was attractive. How much worse of a sacrilege was what was going on in his thoughts than the fact that this person wasn't kneeling during the consecration, when, for all one knows, first of all, it could have been ignorance, it could have been discomfort kneeling, it could have simply been rebelliousness. But even if it was rebelliousness, how less offensive is that than thinking of the Mass as a bachelorette dating show? Anyway, a very contemporary illustration of what Saint Anthony of the Desert is saying here. While we harbor a wild beast in ourselves, to quarrel among ourselves and oppose one another, wishing to have our own way and appear as the most upright. I mean, this seems fairly universal. I mean, you know, we're continually, well, maybe I should just say I am continually, but how often do we wish to have our own way? How often do we wish to appear the most upright? How often are we concerned with the impression we're making on other people? And, you know, how much worse might all of this be than whatever we are mentally criticizing in others? And then St. Anthony goes on to point out that the demons might tempt us by inspiring us with these critical thoughts of others. But if we enjoy those critical thoughts, that's at that point we actually fall into sin. Every man who enjoys sinful thoughts falls willingly when he welcomes the suggestions of the enemies. In other words, if rather than pushing away those negative thoughts of others, those evil thoughts, we welcome them, we feel ourselves in sympathy with, we bring them into ourselves, and we integrate them into the rest of the flow of our thoughts, we are actually consenting with our will to them. And at that point, we're actually sinning rather than simply being faced with temptation. I will go back to the beginning of that sentence of St. Anthony. Every man who enjoys sinful thoughts falls willingly when he welcomes the suggestions of the enemies, and when he expects to justify himself solely by his visible deeds, while within he is the abode of the spirit of wickedness who teaches him every evil. In other words, if we accept those critical thoughts and enjoy them, we are actually sinning. We are inviting those demons into us. And how much worse if we are, at the very time we're doing this, saying to ourselves, well, my visible deeds are good. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not hitting anybody. I'm not yelling at anybody. We think that we're justified by our visible deeds while we're welcoming the demon within by what we're consenting to in our thoughts. When we're initially faced with the temptation of that thought, if we rather than push it away, we welcome it, we're not going to be in a position, we're not going to have justified ourselves by the lack of performing visible sins. We will have already welcomed that demon into us. We will have already sinned in enjoying that thought. And worse, according to St. Anthony, we will have given that demon a foothold within us from which he can go on to inspire actual wicked deeds. Let me continue with this paragraph of St. Anthony. The body of, I actually will repeat that last sentence to give context for the next sentence. Every man who enjoys sinful thoughts falls willingly when he welcomes the suggestions of the enemies, and when he expects to justify himself solely by his visible deeds, while within he is the abode of the spirit of wickedness who teaches him every evil. The body of such a man will be full of shameful uncleanness, for he becomes a prey to devilish passions, which he does not repulse from himself. Demons are not visible bodies, but we become their bodies when our souls accept dark thoughts from them. For having accepted these thoughts, we accept the demons themselves and make them bodily manifest. What St. Anthony is saying is that when we accept those poisonous thoughts, when we begin to enjoy them, we are making ourselves actually a home for the demons who inspire them. And we eventually, the body of such a man will be full of shameful uncleanness and devilish passions, for we actually give the demons at that point a body. Even though they don't have bodies of their own, we give themselves a body, that is our own body, when we accept the demons' entry by accepting their thoughts. Continuing with St. Anthony of the Desert. Having fallen from his heavenly rank through pride, the devil constantly strives to bring down also all those who wholeheartedly wish to approach the Lord, and he uses the same means which caused his own downfall, that is, pride and love of vainglory. These and similar things are the means by which the demons fight us and hope to separate us by God, from God. Moreover, knowing that he who loves his brother loves also God, they put into our hearts hatred of one another, and this to such a degree that at times a man cannot bear to see his brother or say a word to him. Many have performed truly great labors of virtue, but have ruined themselves through folly. It would not be surprising if the same thing were to happen to you too. If, for example, having cooled towards active work, you begin to imagine that you already possess virtues, for there you have already fallen into that devilish disease, high opinion of yourself, thinking that you are close to God and are in the light, whereas in actual fact you are in darkness. What made our Lord Jesus Christ lay aside his garments, gird himself with a towel, and pouring water into a basin, begin to wash the feet of those who were below him, if not to teach us humility? For it was humility he showed us by the example of what he then did. And indeed, those who want to be accepted into the foremost rank cannot achieve this otherwise than through humility. For in the beginning, the thing that caused downfall from heaven was a movement of pride. So, if a man lacks extreme humility, if he is not humble with all his heart, all his mind, all his spirit, all his soul and body, he will not inherit the kingdom of God. Wow, again, there's a lot here. First point that St. Anthony of the Desert is making here is that the prototypical sin, the first sin to enter the created world was the sin of pride, which caused Lucifer to fall. That the enemy of our salvation is that very same Lucifer, that very same Satan who fell through pride. That as pride was the means that brought about his fall, he uses the same means to try to cause our downfall, pride and love of vain glory. The second point he's making here is that the devil knows that, I don't think I can put this into words, but that the love with which we love our brother is also the love with which we love God. St. John said, if you don't love your brother, you're lying to yourself when you say you love God, because if you don't love him whom you can see, how can you love him who you cannot see? And therefore the devil endlessly tries to put enmity between brothers, to put ill thoughts, to put ill will, to put rivalry, to put envy between brothers. Now, of course, St. Anthony of the Desert was a monk, and he was living in some sense in a community of hermits. So the role of brotherhood, so to speak, was perhaps more primary than it is in our lives. But nonetheless, sowing dissension, sowing ill will, producing conflict between people, between any two human beings, is really the bread and butter for the devil. And if I may interject with a topic that I have been studiously avoiding, which is the amount of dissension, conflict within the Catholic Church these days in the face of the scandals which are coming to light. This leaves us a very narrow tightrope to walk, so to speak, because on the one hand, we owe our primary allegiance to the truth and to the purity and honor of God, and any person who, even if he is a dignitary in the church, is guilty of grievous sin or guilty of grievous offense against God, I don't know how to put it. If that's the truth, that's the truth, and we have to live in the truth. On the other hand, at the same time, the very fact of that inevitably sows dissension, sows conflict, sows pride in the sense of separating yourself from that sinner and kind of feeling superior to that sinner, in the desire perhaps to shed light on the situation in order to enable the situation to be purified or cleansed, then that begins to trespass on the territory of speaking ill or spreading scandal or whatever. I'm simply pointing this out. I do not have a solution to propose. It seems to me to be an intrinsic conflict, so to speak, an intrinsic contradiction in how one should behave, and I don't see, I don't have a simple resolution to propose. But it does seem to me that when we're, as long as we're talking about the importance of brother loving brother and how the importance of avoiding in our hearts having hatred of one another or condemnation of one another, I think that what's going on in the church right now makes that a particularly difficult challenge, but at the same time, therefore, a particularly important challenge. Now, with that, I see that I have come already to the halfway point in the program, and usually we take a short musical break about halfway through, which I will do now. Before we go to break, let me remind our listeners that this is a live call-in program, and nothing would please me more than to get a call, and especially if a call comes in during the break, then immediately following the break, I'll immediately, first thing, go to the calls and then continue with the discussion of the day. The number here is 866-333-6279. Or 866-333-MARY, M-A-R-Y, if you wish to call in during the break. And with that, we'll go to the break. You're listening to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria with your host, Roy Shoman, and we'll be back in a few moments. Hi, welcome back to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism with Roy Shoman. Although the show usually dwells on the connection between Judaism and the Catholic Church, today's show, as well as last week's show, has sort of dwelt on the spiritual warfare that takes place in our minds, in our imagination, the show is discussing the spiritual warfare that takes place in our minds, and in doing so, it is going back to the desert fathers of the first few centuries, the contemplatives in the desert who lived in a state of certainly continual prayer, but almost continual contemplation of God, and had a very keen insight into what psychology is supposed to mean, which is the science of the soul, and how the soul and the mind are ultimately the battleground between the enemy, between God and the devil, basically, for our souls. So, I have been reading from some citations from St. Anthony of the Desert. The book I've been using, by the way, is Early Fathers from the Philokalia, which is a compilation of kind of Desert Fathers' greatest hits. And I will now turn to St. Mark the Ascetic and just read some reflections of his on the same theme and talk about them as I go along. And again, this is a live call-in show. If you wish to call in, the number here is 866-333-6279 or 866-333-MARY, M-A-R-Y. So going on to the same topic addressed by St. Mark the Ascetic. Holy baptism gives us complete liberation, but to shackle oneself once more by passionate attachment or to remain liberated through doing the commandments lies within our own free will. If thought is firmly caught in some sinful pleasure, it is through our own willful attachment and is not something that happens against our will. According to scriptures, we have the power of, quote, casting down imaginations, 2 Corinthians 10:5. An evil thought for those who cast it down in themselves is a sign of their love of God and not of sin, for not the impact of the thought is sin, but friendly converse of the mind with it. If we have no fondness for it, why do we linger in it? It is impossible that anything we hate wholeheartedly should have long converse with our heart, unless we are wickedly parties to it. So in a nutshell, this is simply pointing out that, again, we will be tempted by evil thoughts, perhaps thoughts of some sinful pleasure, that is in itself not a sin. And if we cast it away, it is a sign of our love for God and not of sin. It's actually an exercise of virtue. Because the impact of the thought, the coming of the thought, is not sin, but the friendly converse of the mind with it. In other words, us engaging in friendly conversation, so to speak, with that evil thought, with that wicked thought. At that point, it is through our own willful attachment that that sinful thought gets firmly caught in our mind and in our imagination. It isn't something that happened against our will. And at that point, there is an issue of our cooperating with it, and therefore our sinning in that cooperation with it. If we hated that thought wholeheartedly, it would be impossible for us to have engaged it in that continual conversation, which lets it take root. One reason I'm dwelling on this topic today is that basically the church has forgotten to some extent, I should say the church, but too many in the church have forgotten this entire realm of kind of spiritual warfare in the imagination, in the mind. And we're living in a culture which, of course, barrages us with sinful thoughts continually. You can't stand at a bus stop without sinful images being presented to one on the sides of buses or on billboards or whatever. You certainly can't channel surf on the radio or on the TV without being barraged by sinful images. And so the vigilance over the mind and the imagination, which has always been part of growing closer to God, is more important than ever in our day, not less important than ever. And yet it isn't given sufficient attention in, in preaching, but in discussion of the spiritual life. So that's why I chose it for today's topic. Back to St. Mark the Ascetic. Not to experience impacts of evil belongs only to the immutable, not to human nature. Adam also was accessible to suggestions of Satan. In other words, as long as we're human, we're going to be presented with these impacts of evil. What he means there is these evil thoughts approaching us and knocking at the door of our mind. Adam also was accessible to suggestions of Satan, but he had the power to either listen to them or not. The impact of a thought is neither sinful nor righteous. It is a test of our free will. This is why it is allowed to impinge upon us, so that those who incline towards the commandment should be rewarded for their faithfulness with crowns of victory, and those who incline towards self-indulgence should be shown as worthy of condemnation for their faithlessness. But even here we must know that it is not immediately after every change of ours that we are judged as to whether we have proved skillful or worthy of reprobation. But when we have been tried all our life with suggestions, conquering and being conquered, falling and rising again, straying and being directed to the right way, then only on the day of departure will all be counted, and we shall be judged or praised accordingly. So it is not suggestion that is sin, not at all. For although it involuntarily, without our consent, offers us things in a bare thought, we have received from the Lord the power of spiritual doing, and it is within our will, at the first onset of a thought, to discriminate the harmful and the useful, and to reject or accept thoughts, which multiply not through necessity, but through the soul's disposition. Again, here we have the entire science of this spiritual warfare in a nutshell, in a single paragraph. Okay, so just going from the beginning, it is intrinsic in human nature that we will be, from birth to death virtually, assailed by thoughts, some of which are coming from the enemy of our salvation. It began with Adam. He too was accessible to suggestions of Satan. But he had the power to either listen to them or not. It is not the thought that coming popping into our mind that is either sinful or righteous. It is a test of our free will. It is a trial. It is an opportunity for either the exercise of merit or the fall into sin. That's why it's allowed to impinge upon us, so that through that trial, the sheep, basically the sheep and the goats, are separated. Those who incline towards obeying the commandment should be rewarded for their faithfulness with victory over the trial, and those who incline towards self-indulgence should be shown as worthy of condemnation for their faithlessness. But even here, don't despair, because it is not, on the occurrence of each of these trials that our salvation turns. It is only at the end of life, looking back over the entire history of this warfare, that the determination is made whether we have proved skillful or worthy of reprobation. Only after we have been tried with this genre of temptation, with this type of temptation all our life, with suggestions, conquering and being conquered, falling and rising again, straying and being directed to the right way. The suggestion here being that nobody is going to be impervious to it all the time. It's going to be a continual process of falling and picking ourselves up again and doing a little bit better next time, maybe not doing a little bit better next time, but in the long run, gaining more mastery over it and doing better at it. And only on the day of departure, that is the day of our death, will all be counted, and we shall be judged or praised accordingly. And then he closes his paragraph by saying, although it involuntarily, without our consent, offers us things in a bare thought. In other words, the thoughts come to us involuntarily without our consent. It is within our will. God has given us the power to, at the first onset of a thought, to discriminate between the harmful and the useful, to choose whether to reject or accept that thought. And therefore, if they multiply in us, if they grow in us, and if they flower in us, it is not through their own power, it's not through necessity, but it's through our soul's disposition, it's through us having welcomed them. Continuing with Saint Mark the Ascetic, know for certain that the Lord sees into the hearts of all men, and as he promised, he immediately protects those who hate the first appearance of evil thoughts, and does not allow them to multiply and in rising to defile the mind and conscience. But those who do not by faith and hope in God repulse the first inception of thoughts, but take pleasure in them, he leaves without help, as unfaithful ones, to be overcome by subsequent thoughts, which he does not drive away, for he sees that we love their first impact and do not hate them at their first appearance. Okay, this is very sobering, and I don't want to sound like I'm being harsh, I guess. I hope I'm not being harsh. If you don't call in, I have no way of knowing whether I'm being harsh or not. But in any case, it is true that the Lord, it's very sobering to think of, but the Lord knows our thoughts at all times, and he sees into our hearts at all times, and he knows what we're thinking at all times, and he, as I said, knows what's in our hearts at all times. If we want the Lord to dwell in more intimate communion with us, if we want his light on our thoughts, his light in our hearts, then we have to sweep the rooms inside clean. Then we have to purify our thoughts and our hearts gradually, more and more, to make them a welcome abode for him. If we instead invite poisonous thoughts and sinful thoughts, and if our internal garden, so to speak, rather than being nicely weeded and planted with fragrant flowers to welcome the Lord, is instead full of, vile insects and snakes and poison ivy and overgrown thistles and all kinds of things coming from the enemy, it's not, you know, it's not going to bring him in to the same extent. And we have control over that. We have control over that by the purification of our thoughts and our hearts. That's it. And to the extent that we take the opportunity when these temptations arise to choose the Lord's way, he will give us more and more help to continue to do so. And to the extent that we choose the enemy's way, we are giving the enemy more power over our thoughts, and we are boxing out the Lord's sovereignty to the extent that he has that sovereignty within us. You know, that's just it. That's what there is. So it ends up being, you know, being up to us. Without, I mean, you know, I hope I don't sound like I'm preaching. I don't like to get personal because I don't like anything really to be about me, but I'll get slightly personal. You know, I've had a very difficult family situation recently. Both my parents died, and one of my siblings contributed in no small measure to their premature death. And does the devil tempt me continually with thoughts of, you know, hatred towards that sibling, wishing that my parents were still alive and they hadn't been hastened to their death? Of course. You know, it was there for months a continual barrage of resentment, of even, God forbid, desire for vengeance, desire to kind of, you know, let that sibling, you know the horribleness of what was done and so forth. Yes, those thoughts were continually coming to me, and for a long time I was not diligent in pushing them away, and the anger festered within me, the resentment festered within me, the ill will festered within me. The only way to gain, I don't want to say gain mastery over it, but to have that anger go away, to have goodwill towards that sibling return inside of me, was to start becoming more aware at the very first being reminded, so to speak, of what was done, you know, to immediately shut down that thought and push it away. And over time, doing that worked to the point where goodwill has been restored, and the very hostile thoughts I don't know how to put it, but my heart is no longer there, I guess is the best way to put it. But it could not have happened without a guard on the door. You know, it's just like everything else. You know, somebody knocks at the door, you open it a crack, you know, it's a motorcycle gang or something, or it's a, you know, gang of home invaders, you immediately slam shut the door. You know, if you leave the door open and let them come into the living room, you know, you're never going to get those, you know, 18 Hell's Angels out of the house again. The time to do it is when the door is open a quarter of an inch and you can still slam it shut. And it's the same thing with the temptations of the enemy over our hearts and minds. So with that, I think I've come to the natural end of the show. I hope it's been useful to you. It's certainly at least been useful to me to remind myself of the diligence that's necessary. After all, we were created for one thing, which is to praise, reverence, and serve God our Lord, and by this means to save our souls and to help others to save their souls in the same means. And if this is the locus of spiritual warfare, we've got to pay attention to it. We've got to be alert to it. And that was the intention of the show. I hope it's been useful. I hope you've enjoyed it. And I hope that you join us again next week, same time, same place, for Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria. This is Roy Shulman saying bye for now.